From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, keeping gang members out of trouble, we've invited Jim Gallipo back to tell us more about his work as a probation officer in South Central LA. He's worked with the Crips and the Bloods since they began. Also today, making a movie starring homeless people from San Francisco's Tenderloin District. We'll talk with Rob Nilsson about his Tenderloin Action Group. Nilsson's first movie, Northern Lights, won an award at the 1979 Cannes Film Festival. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews a new sitcom starring Shelley Long, formerly of Cheers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The United States and its NATO allies have approved an aerial operation today to enforce the United Nations no-fly zone over Bosnia. Ambassadors of the 16 members of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization back the plan. Between 50 and 100 jet fighters will take part. Meanwhile, the Bosnian Serb leader has called on the self-proclaimed republic to pull out of peace talks if the international community imposes new sanctions on the rest of Yugoslavia. The call came at an emergency meeting of the Bosnian Serb parliament. Delegates are expected to vote on whether to ratify the UN peace plan. Pierre Vickery reports.
The Bosnian Serb leader, Radovan Karadzic, delivered a fiery speech attacking the international community for its alleged bias in the former Yugoslavia and recommending that the Bosnian Serbs pull out of peace talks if the Security Council votes to impose further series of sanctions against Yugoslavia. Dr. Karadzic told delegates he was in favor of rejecting the Vance-Owen peace plan, dividing Bosnia-Herzegovina into 10 semi-autonomous regions, saying Serbs face the biggest challenge to their survival since 1389, when Serbia lost a historic battle with the Turkish Ottoman army. Delegate after delegate rose to reject the plan, accusing the United Nations of bias and of being under the control of Germany, Turkey, and the Vatican. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
The Forest Conference in Portland, Oregon is underway. President Clinton opened the discussion with an admonition to those on all sides of the issue to listen to one another as he listens to them. From Oregon Public Broadcasting, Tess Viglin reports.
President Clinton told conference participants that this day-long effort is not about choosing between forests and jobs. Instead, he said it's time to recognize the importance of both. For too long, Clinton said, politics has mattered more than people and the environment.
The process we begin today will not be easy. Its outcome cannot possibly make everyone happy. Perhaps it won't make anyone completely happy. But the worst thing we can do is nothing.
The president, vice president, and several cabinet members will hear from three panels of industry officials and conservationists and other interested parties. But perhaps the greatest accomplishment of this day will be to have them all sitting at the table together. For National Public Radio, I'm Tess Vigeland in Portland.
The Labor Department says the March jobless rate remained at 7%. Job gains from previous months evaporated. Non-farm payrolls dropped as well. Analysts were taken aback. They'd expected small gains. The service sector was the only area to add jobs. Meanwhile, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has fallen nearly 73 points to 3,366. Trading is extremely heavy. The Nasdaq Composite Index is down 16 points at 670. This is NPR. Minnesota Chairman, or rather Senator, David Duerenberger and two advisors have been indicted for conspiring to make false claims and making false statements to the Senate. The Justice Department says a federal grand jury has handed up the charges. The Republican senator said last fall the Justice Department was investigating about $4,000 worth of reimbursements he got from the Senate for staying in a condominium in which he owned an interest during the 1980s. He was denounced by the Senate in 1990 for the condo deal and for using a book contract to launder speaking fees. A major human rights conference in Bangkok ended today with what Western human rights officials say is a step backwards. The final declaration of the 49 Asian and Pacific countries stressed the importance of national sovereignty over universal human rights. Mary Kay Magstead reports from Bangkok.
The fact
fact that Iran chaired the drafting committee of this week's Human Rights Declaration may have provided the first clue that this was not going to be a breakthrough document in protecting the unprotected. Instead, the 49 participating Asian and Pacific countries bucked Western pressure to accept a universal code of human rights. They slammed this as external interference in the affairs of sovereign nations. Officials from the human rights group Amnesty International retorted that torture is torture, no matter what the culture, and the world's citizens should be guaranteed the right to avoid it and other abuses. Amnesty officials say the outcome of the Bangkok conference has made them scale back their expectations for the World Conference on Human Rights in Vienna this June, the first such meeting in 25 years. For National Public Radio, I'm Mary Kay Magstead in Bangkok.
Two Salvadoran military officers convicted for murdering six Jesuit priests in 1989 have been released from prison. The two were the first to benefit from a controversial general amnesty plan for human rights violators from the country's 12-year-old civil war. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Jim Gallipo has been working with the gangs of South Central L.A. since just after the Watts riots in 1965. He talked with us about his work a few weeks ago, but we wanted to hear more, so we've invited him back. Gallipo is a probation officer with the L.A. Metropolitan Specialized Gang Unit. He was in gangs and ended up in jail more than once when he was young. He was turned around by a devoted father and a probation officer who was willing to give him a break. Gallipo is a physically imposing man with a shaved head. He's white. The gang members he works with are black and Latino. Gallipo's been dealing with wars between the city's two main gangs, the Crips and the Bloods, since they began. Now he has a proposal to bring gang members into dispute resolution boards and other community leadership positions and training programs. I asked him if he could explain what the rivalry between the Crips and the Bloods is about.
What it's about, basically, they don't even know. The guys are killing each other over hassles that they weren't even born when they started out. And basically, like, the Crips were all consolidated, and everybody partied together and got along together, and then all of a sudden they were so large that they started having fights within their ranks, and then rival Crip sets started fighting each other. And, like, for good example, two of the gangs that I'm dealing with, the A-Tray Gangster Crips, which got famous in the Florence and Normandy and the Football Williams and all this type of thing, they have a feud that goes back almost 20 years with the Rollin' 60 Crips. And they are just as deadly enemies, and probably more so, than they are with blood gangs. They hate each other, and they have probably killed more. You know, there's been more killing between the Rollin' 60s Crips and the H-Ray Gangster Crips than there has between each of those gangs and blood gangs, you know.
What is that rivalry about?
Okay, the rivalry was over, it was a girl, it was a fight that turned into a killing, then the gangs fell out, and it escalated over the years to the point where the story has it that there were two brothers living in A-Tray, you know, this within the last 3 or 4 years, who had been, you know, particularly aggressive with the Crips and may or may not have killed, you know, some Rollin' 60s, but, you know, it has it that they were creating a lot of problems in the 60s. So some of the Rollin' 60s organized to go over and get these guys, and they could never get the guys. So ultimately, one guy in frustration, when they went over there, they couldn't get the brothers. They killed the mother, and that was a no-no. And now, like, part of the peace process that started about a year ago was bury the dead homeboys is the slogan. We all got dead homeboys. We've all killed each other's homeboys. Let's bury our dead homeboys and get along. That's fine, and it worked very well in Watts and Compton for a whole year. Yeah, but it did not spread, unfortunately, all over the whole territory. But it did work in Watts and Compton extremely well. And those of us that work in the streets were trying to push this as a concept, bury the dead homeboys. And I had a leader of the A-Trays tell me, yeah, we can bury our dead homeboys, but we can't bury mama. You know, we cannot bury the fact that we just cannot forget that like we can warriors. You know, they consider a lot of themselves warriors.
The truce that started before the L.A. riots last year, that had to do with what you're talking about now, the bury the dead homeboys?
Yeah, well, basically, it happened, started about 3 weeks before the riots. And what had happened was we had in a very short period of time, maybe a week, maybe 2 weeks, 2 3-year-old little girls got killed in drive-bys where their father was the target. Separate gang areas, but it happened. And there were older guys in their 40s, early 40s, in the projects, the Watts projects, who had been around before the Crips and the Blood started. These guys were basically tough guys that were not sucked into, you know, the Crip or Blood thing. But they ended up never matriculating. They always ended up staying in the same neighborhoods and all that. And people knew them and didn't mess with them, and they were not involved in gang activity. But, you know, they couldn't go see each other. Like, let's say two of these guys were friends. One lived in the Nickerson Gardens, which is a Blood project, or any other one lived in Jordan Downs, which is a Crip project. You know, they just couldn't go back and forth visiting each other and bringing the families over because of the fact that the youngsters might shoot them, you know. So they would see each other at liquor stores or in Will Rogers Park, and, you know, they'd still talk. So a couple of them decided... when after these things, we're killing each other. We're killing each other as a race, and we got to do something about it. So they talked about, you know, the young, you know, how crazy the young guys were and all that, and they asked about, do you think you could get some of your young guys to meet with some of my young guys, and we could sit down and hammer something out? And there is a program called the American Program, run by the ex-football player, movie star Jim Brown. And he'd had his guys in all the Watts projects and in Compton for 2 or 3 years, trying, you know, to get something going. So the mechanism was down there. There were guys down there. And these guys ultimately hooked up and supported the older guys that were trying to get the thing together, and a number of them ended up going to having like a meeting. Where, you know, no doubt most of them were armed and all that. They didn't trust each other, but they met and nothing happened, you know. And from this, there were some guys that emerged as spokespersons and leaders. A lot of guys that were really sick of seeing, you know, not only black people killing each other, but, you know, the police coming in and just terrorizing, you know, all this. So these guys, you know, all worked together and ended up formulating, you know, a real desire to make, you know, to stop the killing. And I don't think they even foresaw how fast it would light on fire. There was a guy whose name unfortunately escapes me that was a real bright middle 20s, I would suspect, black guy who was going to school at one of the colleges, SC, UCLA or something. So he went out and researched peace treaties from history, and he found the Camp David Accord between Menachem Begin and Anwar Sadat and Jimmy Carter, and he saw that the formula would very well fit. So they brought this thing down. He reorganized it, you know, changed Anwar to, you know, all this Egypt and Israel to this and that, and it worked. You know, there's a lot of things in there, so they brought that down and they had a framework.
The truce that got started before the riots, how well has that held?
There were gangs who never got involved in the peace, but most of them picked, even my gangs that I talked about, while they never were at peace, there was three levels. The first level was the peace Watson Compton, where you dated each other's girlfriends and hugged and partied together and drank together and all that. And then there was, and these are things I made up as names, the next was the truce level, where you could come into my neighborhood, with impunity, however, immunity, but don't stay too long. You know, you can come through, and that's all that, but no dating each other's girls, no party, and we won't shoot you, you don't shoot us, and we can travel. The third level was what I call the ceasefire, and that was you don't come in our neighborhood, we won't go in your neighborhood, we won't go shooting at you, go looking for you to shoot. You don't come looking for us. And that's unfortunately about where the highest level that my three gangs that I deal with in the proposal ever got to. And that you can put all the gangs in L.A. in one of those three categories.
My guest is Probation Officer Jim Gallipo. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest Jim Gallipo is a probation officer with the L.A. Metropolitan Specialized Gang Unit. Do you expect that there might be violence after the verdict in the trial of the four police officers?
I expect there might be violence any time. I think in no way will it be related to the verdict in any of those trials, because nobody cares about that anymore on the streets. That's old news.
Why is that old news? Everyone assumes that that's still really
central. Well, no one assumes that except the press. You know, this is a media event. You know, the people, if there's another, see, the biggest thing that I'm picking up over the year of being down there all the time is that it's not racial. It has nothing to do with the gangs. What it has to do with is basically upwardly, you know, striving people who feel downtrodden by the taxes, the corrupt political situation, the stagnancy of government, the inability of the government to do anything. These people saw that the police in no way can protect the stores. You know, that if no matter what kind of a riot there is, they're going to be busy taking care of themselves, the firemen, their police stations. They're just numerically, L.A. has very, very few police to do the giant area in the 10 million people in Los Angeles County. I mean, we have a far lower police to population ratio than any other big city. And that's what became apparent to the citizenry of Los Angeles. Hey, I always wanted a Rolex watch. You know, now how am I ever going to afford a $12,000 watch? Never, I can dream about it. Now, there's people who are going to visit their Rolex. They know right where it is and where it's store, and they go see it every week. And then as soon as it hits, they're going to get their Rolex. They know right where it is and, you know, the whole thing like that. Maybe they even got some backups in case somewhere that one's protected. But they know that the police are not going to be able to protect, you know, all the businesses that you know, can be easily looted.
Has anything changed for you since Willie Williams took over the Los Angeles Police Department? Is there any more respect for the police now? Is there a more respectful police force of the community? Are there better relations between the two?
I think he is making a real effort. You know, I don't think he's doing enough. The people he talks to often are people who are fairly insulated, you know, from the streets. It's just like, for an example, in my department, you know, I have no knowledge that he has ever come and asked a street probation officer like myself what's going on. He would talk to our chief or one of our administrators who wouldn't even go down, you know, I mean, would have nothing to do with the neighborhood, and anything he knew would be fourth hand from, like, me reporting to my supervisor reporting to our director reporting to his boss, and, you know, finally it gets up there. I will look forward. I'm going to try, you know, to get some type of a time when he and I could sit down and talk, because I go back to the riots in 65, and there's a lot of mistakes that were made then, particularly in the hiring practices of LAPD. I see the difference as being that I hope Chief Williams understands they got to start hiring a different type of officer. Right now, you have to be, you know, like, you know, practically an ex-Marine who never smoked weed and never did, you know. I mean, the type of guy that they're screening for cannot understand the streets down there.
Would you not make it past their requirements?
Oh, absolutely not. No way would I have ever made it to be an LAPD officer. I have referred guys who are ex-gang members that I know would be great cops, even all the way up to an ex-chief named Jess Brewer, one of the first black chiefs, if not the only black chief, who now is a commissioner. And he wouldn't even push this guy. And this would have been a wonderful, you know, police officer. All he's ever wanted to do since he was a kid was be a cop. He understands the gang. He speaks Spanish, you know, and all that. But the guy had a PCP arrest when he was 18 years old. And since then, he's lived a model citizen life, been a manager of a major supermarket store, has brought his girlfriend at the time, married her, they got two children. She's a checker at the supermarket, so he'd actually probably lose money being an L.A. police officer, but all he's ever wanted to do is that. He passed the mental test, he passed the intelligence, you know, the written test, he passed everything, but he can't get by the interview. And until LAPD understands, you've got to start hiring people from the neighborhood, you know, and you got to and have them work in that neighborhood, you know, then you're going to get movement.
Part of your job is to discipline people who are on probation to make sure that they keep with the rules.
Conditions of probation.
Yeah, the conditions of probation. Thank you. Do you think that that discipline is a healthy thing for them? Are you glad to be imposing discipline on people who probably have not had any imposed on them before?
Yes, that's basically what my job is, because discipline, you know, the way I impose it is life. Try to let them know you got to pay the consequences of your behavior. You know, you got to pay the piper. You're going to do certain things. This is the results. You know they're coming. And, you know, if I get a guy, I mean, some of the worst gang members and the craziest, I have had respect for, because they say, I know I'm going to die by 19. I know what the odds are. I know this, but I'm going out in style, you know. And if they're willing to die at the hands of police, if they're willing to, you know, go to the death row, you know, in San Quentin, because, you know, they feel that it is so important for them to kill a rival gang member or to rob a liquor store, well, then don't cry about it. If you can face up like a man to it, then you and me going to get along. But see, don't come whimpering to me and crying and give me another chance and all that, because this is your chance. By the time you get to me, you are at the end of the line. I get nothing but the worst. By the time they get to me, they're the end of the line. They've already been incarcerated. They've already, you know, everything's come down to the fact that, you know, you got three ways to go out. You can die on the streets. You can do what I'm telling you in terms of following this course of action to get to emancipate yourself, or you can go to, you know, penitentiary or California Youth Authority, which is a junior penitentiary. Those are your three options.
You are old enough to have retired. You've been a probation officer long enough to have retired, but you're not retiring yet. Why not?
Well, because of this proposal.
What's the proposal?
The proposal is a gang abatement proposal that I wrote about 3 years ago, and they are working with me out of Supervisor Yvonne Braithwaite Burke's office, county supervisor, to try to get funding for my proposal, which involves enfranchising really hardcore, tough OG gang members to work with me on three specific target gangs to try to bring real peace to those three gangs. And it's a paradigm that if it works there, it would work anywhere. But the programs that are ancillary to what I'm doing, that I'll be using, are very expensive programs. They just happen to, as God would have it, be in the neighborhoods where I need them. But they're not in any other neighborhoods. So, I mean, if this works, then I would encourage people who are, you know, the leadership of our communities that are serious about stopping gang violence, then they got to put their money where their mouth is and replicate these type of programs everywhere. And once they do it, I think we could stop Crip blood violence.
Are there any dangers for you in getting too close to the people on your caseload?
Absolutely, yeah.
So you try to keep a distance from them, even the people who you really like?
No, I don't. I just try to be objective. You know, I try to keep telling myself that same thing. And, you know, sometimes it works. Like, I had a particular young man, you know, the parts of the job that money just cannot ever replace are this type of thing. I had a guy who was one of the worst killer Hispanic gang members in South Central L.A. I had him and his younger brother, undisputed leaders of this gang. And I was on his behind every day, and I was pushing him and watching him and getting one step behind him a lot of times. And ultimately, I removed him from the home. But he was ready in his progression from a 14-year-old when I got him to, you know, he needed to go do his time, see, because that's the badge of honor, and they put the tattoo on him, show they've been in you know, camp and been in a youth authority and county jail and state prison. Well, he was, you know, waiting his turn, and he knew he was going to do it. It was just a matter of when. But I knew if this guy went to one of those institutions, he'd end up running the institution and organizing it, and we'd never be able to save him. And I saw a real qualities in him that I hoped I could use to turn other guys around. And so I just stayed in his butt, and we fought tooth and nail, and I drag him out to put him in placement facilities rather than letting him go to the institutions where he really wanted to go. So ultimately, I got him to 18 years old. He got off probation. He got a good job. And, you know, he was trying to get with the girl. He got, you know, pregnant in high school. I had one or two babies by that time. I don't know. But I got to, and he loved her. She was a beautiful young woman, and she was smart. And I got to him through her. I was able to convince her not to be with him. Because he's going to die. And what good is the father to your guy shot down on the streets or in a pen? You know, you can bring your babies up to see him. She had too much going for her to have a guy like that. So I convinced her, and she wouldn't marry him. And she wouldn't, you know, ultimately she wouldn't sleep with him, you know, the whole thing, and he was mad at me. And I told him, you know, it's you, it isn't me. You know, I'm telling her the truth. You want her, you got to change your life. Anyway, ultimately we ended up at a wedding. 5-6 years later, after there was an incredible incident where I saved him from getting killed by the sheriff, because they wanted him for a murder that was a trumped-up murder by a rival gang, and I knew it, and I couldn't convince them, and they wanted to shoot him down anyway because it was past behavior. And, you know, I was able to save him, and I got him to commit himself to get out of the neighborhood shortly after that. And he did it. And 5 years later, you know, I get an invitation. You know, he comes by my house. They all know where I live, and left me an invitation to go to their wedding 5 years later. And so I thought, oh, this would be fun. It was back in my drinking days. So my wife and I went to the wedding, and there was a gala Mexican gang wedding, you know, the whole thing. So I'm going to eat a lot and drink a lot, and that's great for me. And all of a sudden, when he gave his groom speech at the reception, he said, I like to have silence, please, you know, and very few guys could ever get that with a bunch of gang members. Everybody was silent. He said, I want to thank everybody for being here. I love you all. But he said, in particular, there was one man who made this possible. And I thought he was talking about his dad or his uncle or somebody. And he made me stand up. And he said, without this man, I would be dead, or I'd be in a penitentiary, and Carmen would never have married me. And I hated his guts for a lot of times for how he pushed me. He said, but I would not be here today if it wasn't for that man. I owe my life and my marriage to this man standing up right there. And I thought about it, you know. And he said, he would not let me fail. He would not allow me to fail. And I never even considered that that's what I was doing. But that's what I do.
Jim Gallipo, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Jim Gallipo is a probation officer with the L.A. Metropolitan Specialized Gang Unit. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, how being reunited with a homeless brother led filmmaker Rob Nelson to create an acting company of homeless people. He just wrapped their new movie, Chalk, starring men and women from San Francisco's Tenderloin District. Cheers is ending this season, but its first female star, Shelley Long, has a new sitcom. TV critic David Bianculli has seen it, and he has some unsolicited advice for Shelley Long. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak insists he has evidence of Iranian attempts to destabilize Egypt. Mubarak alleges Muslim extremists in Egypt are being aided by Iran, with money being channeled through Sudan. He made his comments before leaving for talks with President Clinton. The BBC's Jonathan Marcus reports.
Mr. Mubarak arrives in Washington only weeks after a bomb explosion at the World Trade Center in New York, allegedly carried out by a group closely linked to Islamic extremists in Egypt. President Mubarak said that the threat to his government posed by such groups had been much exaggerated abroad, not least because so many of their attacks were directed against foreign tourists in Egypt. And he insisted that Iran was behind much of the trouble. Money was funneled to the extremists via Sudan. Iran's goal was to dominate the Gulf. The president's comments echo the concerns of a number of other Arab governments, who all allege Iranian and Sudanese interference in their domestic affairs. Last month, Algeria broke off diplomatic relations with Iran and recalled its ambassador from Sudan, accusing the two countries of supporting fundamentalist violence.
The BBC's Jonathan Marcus. Western creditor nations have agreed to reschedule part of Russia's debt. The move is intended to help Russian President Boris Yeltsin. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
A spokesman at the French Finance Ministry said Western creditor nations had agreed to reschedule part of Russia's debt over a 10-year period, saving it, this year alone, $15 billion in payments. The source said this was the first major rescheduling package for Russia since it took over the debt of the former Soviet Union. The rescheduling package was decided at a two-day meeting of the so-called Paris Club of Western Creditors. Russia's main creditor nations in the West are the United States, France, Germany, and Italy. The spokesman said the rescheduling package represents a sign of confidence in the economic reforms being carried out by Russian President Boris Yeltsin. It comes on the eve of his summit meeting with U.S. President Bill Clinton. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
Philip Morris, USA, says it is shifting its business strategy to compete more effectively with increasingly popular discount cigarettes. The largest U.S. cigarette maker will conduct a massive promotion to cut what smokers pay for Marlboro's, the world's best-selling cigarette brand. The company will also freeze its other cigarette prices and beef up other cigarette promotional activities. The moves come at considerable cost. Philip Morris may lose up to 40% of its earnings this year. The news sent the Dow Industrials tumbling today. They closed down 68.5 points at 3,370. Declines led advances by a 4-to-1 margin. Trading was very heavy. This is NPR. Silicon Valley's Intel Corporation announced this week New Mexico has won a giant bidding war for its new manufacturing project. Sally Isley of member station KQED reports.
Intel says the project will be located in a suburb of Albuquerque, New Mexico. New Mexico won a competition with four other states, including California, by offering a huge incentives package for the semiconductor company. The incentives, worth $114 million, include property tax breaks and job training funds. In all, they amount to $114,000 in public subsidies for each of the 1,000 jobs expected to be created at the plant. The announcement is a blow for California, currently home to Intel Corporation. company says California's business tax rate, complex permitting process, and expensive workers' compensation system combined to discourage Intel from building the plant in its home state. But it says California is still in the running for another manufacturing plant, expected to be announced later this year. For National Public Radio, I'm Sally Isley in San Francisco.
Rivers swollen by melting snow and heavy rains are flooding homes in the Midwest and in the East. Pennsylvania officials say up to 10,000 people could be affected if the Susquehanna River crests 8 feet above flood stage today. There's widespread flooding in New Jersey caused by heavy rain. Michigan and Indiana are suffering from snow and ice melt. Don't forget, this Sunday morning, set your clocks 1 hour ahead if you are affected by daylight saving time. Benjamin Franklin's idea doesn't really save daylight, but an insurance study says it may save lives. The Insurance Institute for Highway Safety estimates 200 lives could be saved each year if daylight saving time were in effect year-round. It says the extra hour of evening light increases highway and pedestrian safety. Arizona, Hawaii, and parts of Indiana do not observe daylight saving time at all. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Rob Nilsson's new movie, Chalk, stars homeless and formerly homeless people from San Francisco's Tenderloin District. You can't see it yet. It just wrapped a couple of nights ago. Nilsson has been running an acting workshop for homeless people for close to 2 years called TAG, the Tenderloin Action Group. This is a new turn in a career of low-budget independent films. His first film, Northern Lights, won a prize at the 1979 Cannes Film Festival. Hollywood wasn't necessarily his goal, but neither was Skid Row. He went there to research a screenplay about a homeless veteran. While trying to get backing for that film, Hope for the Fourth Ace, he ended up forming TAG and making his new film, Chalk, about pool hustlers. There was a reason he wanted to write about a homeless person. His brother had been one.
The initial impetus to go down to the Tenderloin and live in one of those hotels and try to know who the folks were that I saw on the streets and had seen for so many years was because my brother had been missing for many years. He would show up from time to time, and there'd be a phone call from time to time from a mental hospital here or jail here or there that my father would get. But we really didn't know where he was for, I don't know, it's up to as many as 10 years, So I got an idea for a screenplay, not based on his life, because I really didn't know what his life had become, but a life of a homeless Vietnam veteran and a lottery ticket. So I went down to the Tenderloin and to learn about the streets and to write that screenplay.
Is that where you ended up finding your brother?
No, my brother had been found right around that time. He had called my dad. He had been picked up off the street some 3 years before by a sympathetic ex-social worker who saw something in him and liked him, got him cleaned up. All his teeth had fallen out, and got him some medical care, got him on to SSI and his Medi-Cal. And so then Greg had stayed with him for a couple of years and then contacted the family. So I went down to Santa Monica where he was living and found him there right around the same time that we were beginning this whole thing.
So did he come back with you to the Tenderloin?
Oh, Greg's in the film. I mean, Greg has now, he and I are together and in my house, and he's working on the film. He's been a member of the workshop. His life will continue to change and evolve. I mean, in many ways, he remains, his most comfortable area is the streets, and to be out in the streets panhandling. And even though he lives with me, he feels most kinship with the folks that he knows out there.
What was his problem? Was it drugs, mental illness? I mean, how did he end up on the street?
Mental illness, yes, and also a lot of LSD back then when people were doing that. He did LSD almost every day for a summer. But he's diagnosed paranoid schizophrenic, and chicken and egg, right? Was the drug first? I don't know much about schizophrenia, but it all seemed to happen around the same time.
The Tenderloin Action Group has a credo, and I want to just read some of it. It says, "I am not to be defined by my problem at the expense of my creative talents. I'm not an alcoholic, drug addict who sings, writes poetry, paints, makes films, makes music, etc. I am an artistic human being who has problems, but I'm not alone. We all do, and substance abuse is only one of them. Did you write this credo?
No, that was written by a man who came to us, really a highly talented, educated guy who had been a school teacher and came from a family that a musical family, who had been a saxophone player, a really brilliant guy, who had I don't know how many year bout with heroin addiction. And we groomed him to be the lead in the film. And unfortunately, he was not able to stay off heroin. And a week and a half before we were to go on, he went back on it, and we felt that it was too risky for the production. So we had then to go out and recruit another actor who, by that time, it was too late to find anyone from the streets. So we have an excellent, more than excellent, really a great actor from San Francisco named Kelvin Han Yi, who is an actor who, with a lot of experience, he was in The Great Wall, for example, and ACT stuff, who has come in to play that part.
Well, I think you've just hit on one of the problems that you're likely to be up against if you're working with people who are homeless, that some of them are users and might go back on, and others might not have the discipline to keep up with it. How much of this have you run into?
Well, it's interesting. The first week, the week and a half before we started to shoot, we lost our lead actor. Another of the leads went on a bender and almost died, collapsed in front of the warehouse. It was either withdrawal problems or whatever, but he also, his heart isn't that great, and he collapsed in front of the warehouse. The paramedics came, brought him to the hospital. He spent a week in there. We didn't know. We thought there's another role we'd have to recast. But he recovered, and he came in, and he has done, I think, just incredible and very surprising work for a man who, up until a year and a half ago, had never acted in his life. But towards the end of the production, it happened again, and off he went. We had to scour Portrero Hill. We went running around looking for him. There we were on the set waiting for him to show up, and he had been missing for 4 or 5 days. But we found him, cleaned him up, brought him down to the warehouse, and brought him under the lights. And it was so hot he collapsed, hit the floor, went back to the hospital. But a couple days later, he came out, and as I say, we finished the film 2 days ago with him there, and we're trying to, he's now living with us in the warehouse. We're trying to do everything we can to get him situated so he can not only move along with us in the workshop, because this isn't just a one film deal as far as I'm concerned. I want to keep going with this until we finish Hope for the Fourth Ace and beyond. But we want to get him some employment and get him stabilized and then back to it. So yes, it has happened enough times for me to know that it probably always will happen.
Doesn't this make you part director, part social worker?
Well, I resist that idea. I just feel that I've met some people who have taught me a lot about stuff. I wanted to know who lived on the streets of America, and I went out, and these folks gave me, without reservation, stuff from their lives, and the lives that they've lived have been amazing lives. So I just think we're some folks that came together and we did this. And no, it's not social work, but it's some friends now. Mm-hmm. And they helped me, and if I were to go under or go down or something to happen to me, they'd be there. And I'll be there for them.
My guest is filmmaker Rob Nilsson. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is filmmaker Rob Nilsson. He's the founder of the Tenderloin Action Group, which runs acting workshops for the homeless. What do you like about working with people who aren't trained actors?
Well, I don't like acting. The problem always with actors is if their training isn't right, particularly for film, is they're always trying to convince you. They're always trying to act to embellish, to do too much, to I just like being, and, you know, acting is not real life, but it's real emotion in an artificial situation, and I find that non-actors are sometimes can get closer to that idea. What we're looking for is real human stuff here. Then there are technical aspects of projecting yourself into another person's skin, but with film anyway, almost always you find that it's very close to a kind of typecasting. There are only very few actors. I'd say John Voight is one, for example, but I think there's only a very, very few actors that are not really themselves in almost every role. You know, Rupert Pupkin, for example, with De Niro, was certainly a different character, but almost always De Niro is De Niro, and there's not that much transformation, in my opinion. And so why should we expect it from non-actors? They come forward, they understand that there is another person here, but they're giving forth from their own life, and when you're homeless, you're pretty close to all you have is your own life. And so that the rawness, the realness of the emotion and the feeling sometimes is very close to the surface.
Can you give us a capsule of the story of Chalk?
Well, yeah, that's a little hard. It's a bit serpentine, but it concerns a family that runs a pool hall in Richmond, California. And it concerns two brothers, one the blood brother of the owner, who is a son that he had with a Korean woman when he was in the Korean War, and who he abandoned along with the woman when he left Korea. And the other is an adopted son. And, the first son is African-American and Korean, and the second son is Chinese, a young kid that he adopted when his parents were killed in Richmond, and he saw that this kid was a pool prodigy, had a natural gift for the game. So the brother from Korea eventually makes his way, looking for his father, into America and finds him, but finds also that he's the dark brother. He's the brother that's not loved, and he's the other brother is the one who's loved more and who is the golden one, who has the skill and who has the talent. So anyway, the two brothers make a team. The Korean black brother goes out and finds marks for the Chinese brother to play back at the Crabtree, which is the name of the pool hall that they have, and then they split the money. And so it all concerns a match that the older brother sets up for the younger brother to play with a known tournament player, but it's really a match that the older brother is setting up that he believes that his younger brother will lose. In a way, it's a kind of a revenge situation. So it's all built around that type of thing. And then the auxiliary characters, the loves and lovers and friends and relatives that hang around in the pool hall.
In 1979, you made a movie called Northern Lights, a feature film that won the Cannes Film Festival Camera d'Or. That's, you know, one of their big prizes. Yeah. I know it played the Art House in Philadelphia. Leonard Maltin includes it in his video guide and describes it as incisive, unforgettable Americana. When you made that film, and it was so well received, were you hoping for the big commercial career?
No, when John Hanson and I made that film, we were hoping to be able to make a career out of making films like that. And at that time, it seemed, you know, that was in 79, it seemed like there was the context that would make that possible. I mean, we had seen Cinema Novo in Brazil, Italian neorealism, the New Wave in France. New Wave means something so different now. Woodfall Cinema in Britain or in England. There were groups that formed and little schools that got started where people were telling the stories of real people without this awful three-act screenplay and this kind of terrible storytelling thing that Hollywood has pushed throughout the world, this awful thing that the plot is all. You know, the plot is not all in Aeschylus. I mean, the plot is not all in Sophocles. The plot is not all in the Bible. I mean, you know, there's character there. There's some other passion that gets involved, and we wanted to pursue that passion. And at the time, there was an audience for that. You know, you had an audience that went to see Bergman and Fellini and Pasolini and early Bertolucci and Satyajit Ray and here Cassavetes in this country, Shirley Clarke maybe on the fringes, and now that's all gone.
The film Northern Lights was about Scandinavian farmers in North Dakota before World War I. Does that connect to your family heritage?
Well, in the sense that Norwegians and Swedes, yes, my people came up to northern Wisconsin, and they came there from North Dakota and from Minnesota after initially having come from Norway. And so I was, so ethnically, yes. And my grandfather was the first filmmaker up in North Dakota, really before the Nonpartisan League and before the events that in Northern Lights, that inform Northern Lights.
So your grandfather made documentary movies?
Yeah, well, he did. My grandfather, it was kind of funny. He had a little film company where he'd go into the little towns and he'd try to sort of gild the lily a little bit and, you know, make them look somewhat more prosperous and you know, paint it up than they really were. And then those films would go to Europe to promote immigration. I think probably it was done through the state of North Dakota or whoever. So he wasn't a true documentarian, but he was there photographing the people.
Did that excite you about movies?
No, I didn't like any of it. My mother had to work for him, and she had to do all this photo tinting, and we had all this equipment in the basement and all these smelly chemicals. And no, I had no interest in it. And it was only I started off as a poet and started off painting, and it was really only much later in life. I didn't get started making films until I was in my 30s. So kind of the family illness didn't strike me till quite a bit later.
What's the next step with Chalk? What kind of distribution do you think it's going to have? Where will it be shown?
Well, when we finish it, it'll go to the festivals. Naturally, try to get it into the limelight as much as possible. And then we, at the same time, start showing it to distributors. But, you know, I have to say, Northern Lights, which won at Cannes, no distributor would touch it. Heat and Sunlight, which won the grand prize at U.S. Film Festival, nobody would touch it. But we distribute our own films. It's like John Cassavetes, who was a friend and a mentor of mine. He couldn't get the system to do anything for him. And so, okay, I mean, I may sound bitter, but I'm not bitter. I am fighting against a system I don't like. And so we will fight. Hopefully they'll join us. Hopefully they'll say, hey, these people have something. And these films that they've never given people a chance really to see, yeah, they are worthwhile. Northern Lights should be re-released. Let's do it. Let's get behind this effort. But if they don't, we'll be out there. I'm known as the Curtis LeMay of independent distribution, saturation bombing parking lots, movie parking lots with flyers. We go out all night and do our work. So in the morning, people know that our film is opening in San Francisco or in New York or wherever. And, you know, we back it up with our elbow grease all the way through the procedure. So if we have to distribute this one again, we will. But we've gotten some interest already from some distributors. I'm going to New York tomorrow to talk to a couple of them, and I hope that they'll see that this is something that people are really going to want to see.
Rob Nilsson is the founder of the Tenderloin Action Group in San Francisco and director of the new movie Chalk. This is Fresh Air. A timber summit opened today discussing Clinton administration environmental proposals. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, how are you covering that on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. NPR's John Nielsen will be reporting from Portland, Oregon about the timber summit, the debate between logging versus the environment there. And my colleague Robert Siegel concludes his series on ethnic Hungarians, reporting tonight from Ukraine and Serbia and Slovakia. Joe Palka reports on news that the AIDS drug AZT does not seem to be as effective as had been hoped. And Bob Mondello reviews two films, Il Ladro di Bambini and Jack the Bear.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Next month, the NBC series Cheers will present its final episode, which will include a return appearance by former cast member Shelley Long, who played Diane. But tonight, after 6 years of trying to establish a film career, Long is back on TV with a new series. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
Shelley Long's decision to leave Cheers is one of those monumental examples of superstar ego and blind ambition. like Pernell Roberts walking away from Bonanza or McLean Stevenson leaving MASH. But now, after a string of disappointing movies and telemovies like Hello Again and The Lives of Trudy Chase, Shelley Long is returning to the sitcom form and beginning what looks like the start of another string of disappointments. This series is called Good Advice and trades on the intellectual innocent image the actress fostered as Diane Chambers. In Good Advice, she plays Susan DeRuza, a marriage counselor who's written bestsellers on how to maintain a happy marriage. She works in an office suite where one of the other occupants is a divorce lawyer named Jack Harold, who's played by Treat Williams. And Jack gets understandably upset when Susan steals one of his clients from their shared waiting room.
Jack, I believe I can help this woman.
I can help her too. Watch. Your husband is sewage. You'd be happier without him. Just tell me what you want and I will get it for you. Then you can write me a check and get on with your life. It would take you 8 years to do that.
Jack, you obviously don't believe in therapy.
Wrong. I just don't believe in marriage.
That's because he's never been married.
That's because I've never met anyone married who was happy.
Susan thinks she's happily married, but when she comes home early from a business trip to surprise her husband, she's surprised to find him with another woman. She is, but we're not. The only surprise in this scene, and this whole show, is how predictable and average it is.
Well, this is what I get for telling 6 million women how to keep their husbands aroused. What a fraud I am!
Susie, don't do this to yourself. You should be mad at me, not at you.
Don't tell me what to do with my anger. I have a PhD in psychology.
Naturally, Susan's gonna dump the husband, probably use Jack as her divorce attorney, and end up in a moonlighting-type love-hate relationship. Or better still, make that a Sam and Diane love-hate relationship. Surprisingly, Williams is more at ease in this pilot than Long is. Then again, he's got a lot less riding on it. Good Advice is co-created by Danny Jacobson, who co-created Mad About You with Paul Reiser, so you'd expect this show to be better than it is. CBS probably did too. It's been holding on to this series since the beginning of the season, and appears to know a loser when it sees one. You could say that Long made a bad choice in her comeback TV attempt, except that she didn't just choose it. The credits to the show include a very significant line, based on a character by Shelley Long. So once again, as when she agreed to star in Troop Beverly Hills, she has only herself to blame. Shelley Long doesn't need Good Advice the series. She just needs some good advice.
David Bianculli just resigned from his position as TV critic for the New York Post, and he's currently writing the next chapter of his life. Fresh Air senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audra Vlahos, Joyce Lieberman, and Chris Fraley. Roberta Shurock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Lorenzo Carcaterra grew up in a neighborhood where lots of the men beat their wives and kids, so Lorenzo and his mother weren't alone. When Lorenzo was 12, he found out the family secret. His father had murdered his first wife. On the next Fresh Air, Lorenzo Carcaterra talks with us about his memoir. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.